I'm John Levy, and this is Win the Day with James Whittaker.
You're listening to Win the Day with James Whittaker.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
Broadcasting from Los Angeles, California, here's your host, James Whittaker.
Let's go!
Hey winners, welcome back to Win the Day. If this is your first time here, we sit down with some of the world's true change makers to give you all the tips, tools, and strategies to win the day every day. The quote for this episode comes from Maya Angelou and says, "When we give cheerfully and accept gratefully, everyone is blessed." Our guest today is John Levy, a behavioral scientist known for his work in human connection, trust, and influence. John specializes in applying the latest research to transform the ways companies approach marketing, sales, consumer engagement, and culture. His clients range from startup companies right through to Fortune 500 brands like Microsoft, Google, and Samsung. More than a decade ago, John founded the Influencers Dinner, a secret dining experience for industry leaders ranging from Nobel laureates and Olympians right through to musicians and executives. John's second book, You're Invited, The Art and Science of Connection, Trust, and Belonging, was released to critical acclaim, quickly rising as a New York Times and international bestseller. In this episode, we're going to talk about how to accelerate the process of building trust and influence, the biggest mistakes people make when it comes to connection, how your social circle impacts self-belief and success, and what you can do to start making better decisions right now. Before we begin, the right bit of inspiration can completely change the trajectory of someone's life. So if there's a friend or loved one out there who needs to hear this episode or could use some help to win the day, share it with them right now. All right, let's win the day with John Levy. John, great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm super excited to be here. That quote, that was fantastic.
It's a great one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I always try and pick a quote that's like, you know, really suits the theme of what I believe the conversation will be about. And I thought you would like that one, so I'm happy you mentioned it.
What I specifically liked about this, and is it okay, we dive right in?
Yeah.
It said something about giving.
When we give cheerfully and accept gratefully, everyone is blessed.
And I love this because, you know, I spend much of my time as a behavioral scientist really focused on the way that relationships function. And the tendency, at least in American culture, is to think that if I do it all on my own, that makes me a success. And so we'll often be okay with giving, like, oh, I'll give advice. And then if I have a problem, I'm going to do it myself. And where people really slip up is in letting other people contribute to them, is that second part. Mm-hmm. If we don't actually allow people to invest into us, they'll care less. We're missing out on an opportunity to develop deeper relationships.
It's so true. And it's like this idea of just everyone being blessed. If you're in a family, you want the whole family to be a success rather than one individual. If you're in a business, you want the whole business to be a success rather than one individual. You know, it's really important, that idea of that sort of abundance mindset rather than trying to have some type of individual pursuit and success and that being the main drive.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because what we're actually seeing right now is that since so many people are now in their working from home after the pandemic, then we get excessively concerned with just ourselves, right? There's this thing called it's kind of a weird research study. An MIT researcher was curious, can I predict the number of, or who will be collaborating or talking to each other? And what he found was that the predictor was how close two people's desks were to each other. So the closer our desks are, there's an exponential growth in the frequency that we talk to each other over text, over email, all of it, phone calls. But now that everybody's away from each other, we forget that there are other people. And in the process, it leads us to get obsessed with ourselves. And so people are like, oh, I'm just more productive at home. But when we focus solely on our own success, it actually limits the entire potential of the organization or company because we get too focused on our just individual metrics.
For sure. Have you noticed, like I certainly have with the people that I've been working with, this deterioration of self-care? And that might not just be necessarily a product of living in a post-pandemic world. Might also be just in terms of the very digital age that we're in at the moment, where we're just blasted with just so many messages. Have you noticed a bit of a deterioration in terms of people looking after themselves and that leading to some potentially negative outcomes in their life?
So I think we're seeing like a weird dichotomy, right? You see these people saying things like, oh, good vibes only, or, oh, I'm I'm California sober, right? Which means that they don't drink alcohol, but they consume a lot of other kinds of of like drugs, right? You know, listen, I'm not judging. I'm just saying, like, it's this kind of funny dichotomy of that on one side. And then you get also like these biohackers who do really funny things that they're like, okay, I'm going to spend the next 4 hours in a hyperbaric chamber so that it'll extend my life. The problem is the greatest predictor of living a long time, I mean, after genetics, because we currently can't affect genetics to a meaningful degree. There's like some new therapies coming out, but the biggest predictor on the low end is like clean air and water, getting your flu shot, especially when you're older, right? Getting exercise is decent. Quitting drinking is a pretty decent deal. Quitting smoking is a really important thing. But the number two greatest predictor is having close friends and family. And the number one greatest predictor is something called social integration. It's the number of people you come in contact with in a day. What we're seeing is about since 1950, post-war sentiment in the US begins to decline. The television enters the home and people go from being parts of active communities, like everything from knitting clubs and reading groups and bowling, to in 1985, the average American had three close friends besides family. By 2004, we were down to two, and now it's even lower. And so I would argue that, yes, we're seeing a massive decline in our mental well-being. And one of the biggest issues around that is fundamentally loneliness and a lack of human connection.
Mm. I think that's a good segue to a question that I wanted to ask you. Like, I feel like it's surely no coincidence the line of work that you're in. Was there a story or experience that you had from your childhood where a lack of connection and trust deeply impacted you?
I mean, I think that probably happens to everybody, right? I mean, there's a lot of kind of things that shape the way that we view ourselves. I remember in... In eighth grade, I went to a small school. There were eight kids, no, there were like 16 or 17 kids in my class. And one day the homeroom teacher, like the main teacher, says, hey, we're going to reassign everybody seats. And we're going to let you secretly submit two people you want to sit with and two people you don't want to sit with. And through a weird series of events, I ended up discovering that there was one kid that nobody wanted to sit with. And I then also discovered that that kid was me. And I was heartbroken, right? Like, I always knew I wasn't that popular. I was super geeky. But it didn't occur to me that I was literally like the person that nobody wanted to be around. And I think that really pushed me into becoming a behavioral scientist. You know, maybe if I understand people, I could make some friends.
For sure. How did that moment play out with you for the rest of high school? Was there a sense of you wanting to be more of a people pleaser, or did you naturally sort of retreat more into your own shell?
I ended up, because that school ended at eighth grade. So, and then I went to high school. So I kind of got to reinvent myself.
Good timing.
Yeah. It was very healthy. Let's just say that. I still wasn't particularly popular, but I also, like, it was once again a small school and I had some friends, which was like a nice change of pace. I think for most people I talk to, they talk about how their high school days were pretty awkward. And how I feel like I'm one of those people who peaked much later in life.
Me too, which is good. Yeah. It's good for us peaking at the moment rather than peaking in high school.
Yeah, you don't want to be the person who peaks in high school. Let's just be honest. That's like an awkward way to live your life.
For sure. Very important to succeed as much as you can, but you need to sustain that success rather than, dying out too early. This idea of your social circle, how does that impact your self-belief? Like the people that you hang around, how does it impact your self-belief and then how successful you'll be or the actions that you will take that will obviously lead to that success?
So I think that there's kind of two aspects to it. The first is that when you really have a deep understanding of human behavior, you begin to realize how much of it is dependent on other people. We talked earlier about how, like, there's this idea of lifting myself up by my bootstraps. And, like, that's total BS. Let's just be honest. We are fundamentally intertwined with the people in our lives. Now, there was a wild study by these two researchers, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler. They were curious about the obesity epidemic. This was the early 2000s. And they were curious, does it spread from person to person like a cold? Or is it a percentage of the population like Alzheimer's? And what they discovered was shocking. They found that if a person has a friend who's obese, their chances of obesity increase by 45%. Their friends who do not know them have a 20% increased chance, and their friends have a 5% increased chance. And this kind of effect is true for happiness, marriage and divorce rates, smoking habits, voting habits, basically any characteristic that you could imagine spreads from person to person. And people always ask, oh, is that because by chance, is it like where you're hanging out? And the answer is like, a lot of things are all of those things, right? Meaning, if I am a fitness junkie, I'm more likely to have fitness friends. And so we go for a run rather than eating a tub of popcorn at a movie theater. So when I came across this research, and there's a whole slew of studies that really support it, I realized that my job, if I want to, as you would say, win the day consistently, is not just to get to know one or two really successful people. It's about meeting the extraordinary people across every industry and topic, and hopefully connecting them with each other. Because let's say I know you, maybe I'll become a better interviewer, right? As we're having conversations, you'll be like, oh, you might want to ask this question and I'll learn from you. But if I also have friends who are professional athletes or Navy SEALs or whatever you could imagine, doctors, I'll then begin to understand how decision-making occurs in different places, and my habits will be absorbed from all of them. And so I wanted to connect all of them with each other so that everybody positively impacts each other.
Mm, I love that. What about someone who, you know, you mentioned the importance of connection there and that integration with the people that you're around. What if someone is in a fairly toxic environment and it's difficult for them to be able to find positive role models? Are there any particular things that you have learned in terms of being able to rise above those circumstances, which I would imagine would first have to start with mentally accepting and having the awareness of like, look, I'm in a bit of a difficult environment here. I have aspirations to be better than the environment that I'm in. What can those people do to start to succeed despite their meager circumstances?
I think that we're in an age where we have this unparalleled ability to access people who we admire. And I'll give you a simple example. Let's say you want to become a better athlete. And in your environment, people are eating lots of junk food. They're not really exercising. The number of Olympians that nobody actually pays attention to is pretty incredible. These are the most elite athletes in the world. And if you were to message them, just DM them on Instagram, you will probably get an answer. Now, Michael Phelps might not, but there's a whole team of swimmers that went to the Olympics with him, and they are all exceptional athletes. And so you would be surprised at the number of people who would respond. You will be surprised how easy it is to find a Nobel laureate's email address because they publish scientific papers and they're just on the internet with their papers. You would be incredibly surprised how many business executives would love to mentor somebody, especially if you have a story about being in an environment where there aren't many opportunities and you want to be able to accomplish more with your life. So there's a whole ton of different techniques you can actually use to get a higher response rate from them and connect more deeply with them. And we can cover all that. I would say that we're really fortunate that that option exists. And people who've achieved have a very large tendency to want to mentor and give back. The second thing is, I think it's really important to figure out if the environment is toxic or if I'm the one being toxic, right? So I understand that there's certain environments where people have less resources and so on. But there have been many occasions in my life where I was angry, frustrated, blaming other people, and had to realize that I was the one that was creating the problem and the drama. And it's a tough thing to look at, but it's always worth the question.
For sure. You brought up something there in that first point, which I think is so interesting. People just naturally, because of influence, like you mentioned in your book, they want to connect with David Goggins without realizing, and they're lamenting the fact that, oh, I'd wish I could connect with David Goggins, but I can't, without recognizing that there are hundreds of other Navy SEALs out there. There are people from the Naval Special Warfare Development Group who you could connect with, who had the right approach, who might have a lot more expertise than him in that domain that he's so regarded for. But the reason you want to connect with someone like that is because he has this influence. It's almost like I don't want to say artificial, because obviously he's someone who's motivating and doing a lot of good in the world for a lot of people. But sometimes the heroes we champion aren't the best position to be able to help us get to our next step.
So there's this human bias known as the mere exposure effect, which is that the more frequently we come across something, the more we tend to like it and trust it. And the people that become like the famous leaders are those who either stumbled on it somehow, or they're really extroverted or good at marketing themselves. For every one of them, like those loud CEOs that gets lots of attention, like, you know, maybe a Steve Jobs, there's probably 100 or 200 or even 2,000 people who are maybe not exactly as successful, but equally talented, smart, and maybe just have slightly different values. Maybe they didn't want to dominate the cell phone industry and they wanted to spend more time with their kids. So their company's only worth, you know, $20 billion and not, you know, $1 trillion or whatever. That's still going to be a really, really good person to have as a mentor, right? But nobody's approaching them because nobody knows that, like, oh, they created the cell phone towers that make cell phones work rather than the cell phone.
It's like the blue ocean versus red ocean strategy. Everyone's trying to fight for the most, you know, the people with the highest influence rather than figuring out, well, who are these amazing people who could serve as a mentor for me? I think that's such a great point. And you mentioned there some tactics in terms of outreach and—
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'd love to hear about that. But there was one thing you actually wrote in your book, which I love, and I wrote that down. You said, I realized that if I wanted to connect with influential people, I needed to understand what they value. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly been my focus as well, while at the same time, it's turning myself into someone who can be as valuable as possible, like really getting as close to my own potential as I can, because the more valuable I become, the more abilities I have to be able to help other people with the value that they need. So what are some of those tactical things that you use to help? And obviously, we can dive into that more as well in terms of being able to connect with influential people.
So let's first look at what their lives are like, because if you want to connect with somebody really influential, and my parents are immigrants, like I had no concept of what it was to be like crazy successful. My father is a painter and sculptor, somehow managed to support the family. So the first thing we have to understand is that basically their life is defined by the fact that everybody wants something from them. And I'd say it kind of falls into five categories. They want their social clout because being around them gives them status. Oh, I was just hanging out with, let's say, David Goggins or whatever, right? They want their time, their expertise, their access, and their money. And so if everybody's after these things, then in general, their defenses are up. And so we need to now understand what will actually get them not just to notice you, but to have interest, right? There's a difference between getting attention and having interest. Attention is like a car backfires, it has my attention. But a car backfiring doesn't have my interest. I'm not going to go over the car and get to know the owner, whatever it is, right? And so for that, we want to understand how the brain works. And there's a handful of characteristics that really put an advantage in your situation. The first is if you're doing something that's really generous, meaning if you actually give people more than they're expecting to receive. Now, I don't mean like gifts and things like that. People tend not to actually value gifts that much. But rather, if they don't think that you're after all their money, then it reduces the risk that they're concerned, right? The second, and often almost more important, is novelty. When something stands out as unique or different, then it triggers a section of the brain called the SNVTA. It's like the major novelty center. And it causes us to be really interested and want to explore and understand it. So when you do something that stands out as unique, people become curious and want to interact with you. The third is curation. The most influential people in the world, everybody thinks they spend all their time with other influential people. They don't. They mostly spend their time heads down working and with their admins, sometimes with their family. And so if you have an opportunity for them to connect with other influential people, they will go far out of their way for it. Like, have you ever heard of Davos, for example? Mm-hmm. So Davos is this gathering, just for your listeners know, takes place in Europe, middle of winter, it's cold, it's literally like a pain in the butt to get to. And it's a place where like Bill Gates will hang out with the head of the EU and, you know, all these other kind of fancy people. And they're willing to go out there and spend a fortune to be there because everybody else is there. Could they hear the same content somewhere else? Sure. It's the same thing with TED. So if you can curate an environment, people go far out of their way for it. And the final thing is really awe or wonder. It's arguably the most desired human emotion. And if you can trigger that, it's very hard to do. You will be unforgettable. And so I don't think you have to meet all of those things the first time you interact with somebody, but I think that there's certain things that'll put you in, like, put the odds in your favor. Mm.
Stack the deck.
Yeah. Not to sound like the Hunger Games, but yes, like may the odds ever be in your favor. Yeah. But here's like a simple thing. Okay. I probably get 100 requests to connect on LinkedIn every month or so. And they all say the same thing. Oh, I want to increase my network, blah, blah, blah. And it's clear it's like, it's meaningless. They've sent the same message to probably thousands of other people in hopes that I'll say yes. And then their content will be on my news feed and they'll get to market to me, right? If instead I messaged you and I said, hey, I loved your last episode. I don't want to take up much of your time, but can you recommend your two favorite books or your favorite book? And then you're far more likely, first of all, to respond. But something really weird happens. The moment that you respond with this little thing, something called the IKEA effect kicks in. And the IKEA effect is that we care more about our IKEA furniture because we have to assemble it. So the fact that you invest effort into responding to me means that you care now more about my results. Now, if I then come back 2 weeks later and I said, oh my God, I loved the book. This was so good. I especially like these topics. Any chance I could have just like 5 minutes of your time to talk about it? Now that I've actually followed through with the investment of effort that you gave me, you are far more likely to say yes. Now, if I were to just send you a message point blank being like, will you be my mentor? Who's going to say yes to a unpaid part-time job for a stranger?
When we're already time scarce and trying to spend time with our own families.
Yeah. Or get that final email out or whatever it is, or make sure the client is happy and a million others. If you're going to do outreach because you want to develop a mentoring relationship with somebody, or even a client or something, I recommend using this technique, which is called stacking. Researchers have people stop strangers on the street and ask for complex directions. Overwhelmingly, they did not get the answer. And then they had people stop strangers on the street and ask for the time, and then ask for the directions. And almost everybody then got the directions. And the reason is that once you are viewed as somebody worthy of some effort, you are worthy of more effort. You're now familiar. And so people are invested in your outcome, which means that our best bet is to ask for something small with a very low lift and then ask for a bigger thing. And that's how relationships are actually built.
Yeah. And if you look at LinkedIn, it's just a shotgun approach. One of the most interesting things is that, so Win the Day, wherever I have it online, it has the registered trademark symbol afterwards. Mm-hmm. But whenever any of that crawling software is there, it will always stuff up that registered trademark symbol. So I know straight away if it's like part of a mass mail out or whatever. And
oh,
my God,
so
these are so bad. And it makes me, I had to just get off LinkedIn because I cannot stand how bad. There was one guy the other day who somehow got my phone number and texted me. This guy asked to connect with me on LinkedIn. I don't even, I'm not even looking at this stuff, whatever. I'm just like, accept. I don't particularly care unless it's someone who says something bad, then I won't connect with them. So this person connected with me, I accepted, and then texted me, and then obviously sent the three or whatever it is, usual messages about
the drip campaign.
Can we catch up? Whatever. Texted me and said, you connected with me on LinkedIn and we still haven't scheduled our chat yet. And then sent me another one a couple of days later. Basically, this was from this power stance where it was being like, why haven't I given that person the time of day that they wanted?
You're being very rude.
Yes. Exactly. And I could not wait. I gave this person a response that they will never, ever forget. I wasn't like, I wasn't angry emotional, but I was very firm.
You're a better person than me. I get angry emotional.
Yes, for sure. I was like, how dare this person? Like, first of all, how did you even get my number? I know there's some software that you probably use to do that, but how dare you reach out to like my private phone and do these things? I cannot believe that people are employing these tactics. And even worse, I cannot believe there are people who are teaching this. You and I are two very big proponents of adding value and building connections and doing things the right way.
I love that people do it that way. Mm. I absolutely love it because it makes you look so good. I mean, just like think about this. When the other like 70% of people are harassing others out there and you're like, hey, I'm a really nice guy. I'm not going to bug you. People love you. So of course, I'm totally fine with me. Listen, I think it's the dumbest thing you could possibly do because you are burning and destroying relationships left, right, and center. And the problem is, to some degree, this stuff probably works, right? So they probably get the phone calls, they probably book a few people, and But like, is that really, if that's a person you want to be, hey, go for it. It's, you just end up making me look really good.
Exactly. And then compare that to, say, having a podcast where you, you know, you and I are meeting today for the first time. We had a couple of dealings and stuff via email and all that, but we're meeting today for the first time properly. Yeah. We got a bunch of mutual friends, so that makes it very easy to connect. But by the time we've left, you know, a 1 hour conversation or whatever it ends up being, we've covered so much great stuff in an uninterrupted environment that's a great foundation for a friendship for life. And it's really one of the main reasons I do the podcast, is because more than 80% of the people who come on the show end up being extremely close friends of mine. I know what they want in life. I'm focused on staying connected, and it's a really great way of doing that.
Yeah.
It's pretty similar to the way it sounds like you do it with the dinners. Would you mind talking a little bit about the process of your dinners and what type of results or how that has really contributed to your life?
The contributed to my life, that's such like a tough thing, but let me explain for the people listening. 13 years ago, I was designing this model to understand how influential people actually behave and interact, basically because of that study about how contagious people's behavior was. I was, I don't know, must have been like 28, 29. I was like overweight, broke, right? Like it was just a mess. And I would keep beating myself up for not waking up at 6 a.m. and going to the gym. I'd keep hitting the snooze. I'd be like, okay, maybe if I had some friends who are Olympians, I'd actually exercise. And I end up like coming to this understanding about these characteristics and everything. And I was like, okay, how do I put this to the test? And I created a secret dining experience. We invite 12 people at a time. They're not allowed to talk about what they do or even give their last name. Like it's completely anonymous. And when they arrive, they then cook a meal together. And the food is just terrible. Like it's god awful. I mean, like it's fine. Nobody's ever gotten like sick or anything, but like we generally like make burritos, and you could get a better burrito at Chipotle. It's not like, this isn't like you'd think, you know, fancy people. Anyway, they sit down to eat, and as they're eating, we play a game to figure out what people do, and they find out they're with Olympians, astronauts, Nobel laureates, and so on, right? And it's really wonderful for a whole slew of reasons. One is because they're such diverse backgrounds, then the Olympian isn't like comparing themselves to the Nobel laureate, because both achievements are insanely difficult, and you can have a mutual respect, as opposed to like, sometimes you get at these conferences and it's like, oh, that's so-and-so, they have so many followers and this person only has this many, so this person's better, you know, all that. And then the other thing is that we really build it on the behavioral science of human connection. So I mentioned that IKEA effect, right? Because we're investing effort into cooking together, then the guests actually care more about each other in a short period of time. Now, we don't license it or anything, but what we often tell people is like, if you're going to do something, you want to connect with people, find something that requires some effort. Don't just like go for coffee, go for a walk or work out together. Sweating together is a great way to bond and build familiarity. Find situations where vulnerability actually gets created. There's this kind of interesting thing. I didn't understand for years why the dinners worked so well, but they were like wildly effective at having strangers just feel super connected. And it turns out that generally people think that if you trust me, you will be willing to be vulnerable with me. But it turns out that it's backwards. It's the most basic unit of trust is actually something called a vulnerability loop. And it works like this. When we were walking in, you were telling me about your kids, right? And I shared that I have a newborn. So imagine before my newborn was born, I was kind of freaking out. And it wouldn't be uncommon for me to be on a call with somebody and be like, oh my God, you know, I've never changed a diaper. I'm freaking out. I have no idea what I'm doing. Now, in that moment, if I call you up and I say that, you could make fun of me, right? So I signal vulnerability. If you make fun of me or ignore me, trust is reduced. But if you acknowledge it, and you this is what you did in our conversation, you said, oh, John, I totally get it. You know, and then something like, before I had kids, I had no clue what I'm doing. I'll run you through changing a diaper. It's okay. The moment that I see that you've signaled vulnerability to the same degree, trust increases to that higher level. It goes, person one signals, person two acknowledges, person two signals, person one acknowledges, trust increases to this higher level. And that's how trust is built. It's one of the reasons that if people like overshare, then the next person can't signal, right? They can't fill the gap. If you're like, I'm getting a divorce, and they're like, nice to meet you. Like it doesn't add up, right? You can't span the gap. So in the dinners, we open and close loops really quickly because there's a time constraint and people have to get a job done. And so when I am chopping something, I say, hey, can you pass me the, and before I finish the sentence, somebody puts a cutting board in my hand. That's an open and closed loop. I put my hand out, they put the cutting board in, I take it from them. It's an acknowledgement. And so any opportunity you have that opens and closes loops, you could be playing board games together, you could be on a team playing a sport, you could be working on a project, volunteer work, hiking, anything you could imagine, right? But that actually requires a joint investment of effort. That will bond you way faster than, can I pick your brain?
Absolutely.
We'll be back with the show shortly. I've got a quick question for you. Are you living up to your potential? It's a question that shapes your family, your business, and your overall happiness every single day. That's why I'm excited to introduce the Win the Day Quiz. Head over to winthedayquiz.com right now, answer a few thought-provoking questions, and you'll instantly discover how well you're performing relative to your true potential. And here's the exciting part for our Win the Day family. As a fan of the show, you'll receive a personalized and absolutely free action plan to help you win the day every day. Now, just imagine how transformational the results will be when you consistently show up as the best version of yourself in every aspect of your life. Don't miss out. Take the Win the Day quiz now by visiting winthedayquiz.com or click the link in the show notes. All right, let's get back to the show.
If you're working with a company or a company has approached you about helping them build trust as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. are there any specific questions that you ask them first or any information that you want to know beforehand before you then get into all that in terms of like giving them recommendations or a process that they'd follow?
So there's certain things that are pretty standard that work across the board, but I really like to know what the company's values are and what their budget is. And one of the most important thing is, you know, one of the reasons that we eat terrible food, it's like, it's fine, whatever, right? Is that, well, first of all, I had no money when I first started. Like, I was totally broke. I was going into debt paying for these dinners. So I didn't have an option to do something expensive. The second is that it serves as an example that deep human connection doesn't actually cost money. If you look at the poorest communities in the world, those are the ones that are most intertwined and connected because they need each other. When you have billions in the bank, you can, you know, have food delivered to you. You could have everything taken care of and you're not dependent on people in the same way. So when I work with a company, I want to know, okay, what are your values? Because we want to do activities or have conversations consistent with those values. The second is, what's your budget, right? What do you actually want to spend? Because we could literally invent games that cost nothing that people use resources around their house like paper and pencils, or we could go all out. And, you know, I did one with a big tech company where we, in the parking lot, had a company come in and build a fake brick wall. And then we taught them, this was because of the pandemic, we had limited options. So we had gave people head-to-toe PPE and they didn't know what was going on. And then we had a master street artist teach them how to spray paint. But because it was the pandemic, we were able to put them in fully protected gear that was part of the activity. And so it was like this immersive experience that then they were spray painting on each other because they had protective gear, it was all fine. And they were taking, you know, it was like just this wonderful bonding, intimate experience in a way that was really safe during a time that was really dangerous.
Was there a moment at any of the dinners that you've organized where you were like, it was just a complete disaster, or you were like, wow, I cannot believe that this has happened?
I, you know, I've hosted, today will be dinner 335. I host about 100 events a year. And today might be the biggest disaster so far. and I'll tell you, over the past like 72 hours, no, a bit more than that, we had the original host, because I don't live in LA, the original host realized that they have to go run an event so that we couldn't do it at their house. We went to somebody else's house. They had just ran an event at their home, which was a super spreader. Everybody got sick. So now we had to relocate everybody once again. It's now finally at this person's house. They found out they have a gas leak. So the California Gas Company, whatever it's called, SoCal or whatever, shut off their gas and we're cooking. So
Come fast. I know that from personal experience. Yeah. The SoCal Gas Company does come out.
They'll shut it off fast. I don't know if they'll turn it on fast. So the problems that occur are technical. They don't tend to be human. And the reason is, I think, threefold. One is like the nature of the event is self-selecting. If you are a total jerk and are very self-important, it's probably not a great environment for you to be in because you're not allowed to talk about how important you are, right? The second is, since you don't know who's there, then being like dominant or whatever it is would be kind of weird because the next person over could be 10 times more successful than you, and then you just look like a total jerk. So we tend not to have those. I think like the worst thing that's probably ever happened is somebody was overly flirtatious or somebody got a little drunk. Like, it's just not that interesting. We also only have one conversation around the dinner table, so it limits a lot of potential awkwardness.
Yeah, you've made the news for all the right reasons then.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's mostly the technical thing. We also have a design philosophy that's really kind of wild and different than I think most people out there. Like, if you look at most events that people go to, they get obsessed over the food, the flowers, like the things that, the aesthetics. And I don't even bother with any of that because we really just care that the people walk out with new relationships, because there are far more people that come than I can be friends with. Like, it's just not realistic. I've hosted over 3,000 people, which means that the focus is them and them bonding. If I can get people to walk out with like one, two or three friends, I know, like, that's awesome. And so if you want, I'm happy to talk about the actual way we design, because it's kind of different. And the way we design is built on a model called the elephant, the rider, and the path. There's no perfect analogy, but if we were to describe it in like a simple way, I'd say that the brain is like an elephant with a rider sitting on top. The elephant is our emotions, our biases, and our mechanics. They're very big, very strong. Our elephant is more like that logical side that tries to guide our behavior. Now, in the morning, the rider is full of energy and can kind of guide the elephant around, make sure you eat a healthy breakfast. But by like 5 o'clock, that rider is so tired that that elephant, if it sees a candy bar on your counter, is going to eat it. And you are never more creative than when you justify eating something you're not supposed to eat. Right? I worked out yesterday or whatever it is, right? Now, most companies focus on speaking to the rider. Oh, it is good for you. Come into the office. It's good for you. We're more productive. Nobody listens to that. Smarter companies speak to the elephant, right? Apple makes you feel unique and special for owning their product, just like everybody else, right? But it's on an emotional level. And that's much more effective because the elephant is bigger and stronger. And most of our decisions are frankly emotional or convenience. But there's a third option. And to understand that, I have to ask, how long have you been living in the US?
11 years.
Okay. Have you ever been to Walt Disney World, the one in Orlando?
I'm not in Orlando. I've been here a couple of times.
Okay. So the one in Orlando has a really unique design. You drive in, park your car, go up an escalator, buy a ticket, and then you either board a 23-minute monorail or a boat ride to get to the front entrance of the Magic Kingdom, and then you go in. Now, the head of the Disney Institute, which is their research group, asked a group of us, why don't we just put the ticket counter at the entrance? Like, why would we have people go on this trip and all that? And people are like, anticipation. And he's like, nobody's accidentally in Orlando. Like, you've been anticipating, like, it's just not a place where you stumble, right? It's not like, oh, my plane landed here, I have 24 hours free. It's, you know that you're—
You're there for theme park, right?
Yeah.
Theme park central.
You've been anticipating it for months. He said, here's what's really interesting. At the time, the average income in the US after taxes was about $44,000. For like a family to go to Disney for a few days, it's something like $1,200. So when the tickets are purchased, that's like the mortgage and a whole bunch of, like, the equivalent of a massive portion of their disposable income. So it's not uncommon for people to be emotionally struck. We sometimes call that buyer's remorse. And what they realized was that you can't really convince people that you've made a good decision. Like, you should feel good about this. No, you can't logic your way out of that. So speaking to the rider doesn't work. And you can maybe do some stuff emotionally, right? Like, you put cute things around so that you're excited and all that. But what they realized was that there's a certain length of time that it takes most people to process that purchase. Any guesses how long?
The Disney specifically?
Yeah.
Probably fairly quick.
I'll give you a hint. The monorail takes about 23 minutes.
Yeah. Well timed. Very research driven, is it, with all that?
So, I mean, they claim, I don't know if it's by chance, but they claim that it takes about 23 minutes. So that way, when you enter the Magic Kingdom, it can actually be the happiest place on earth. So you're not yelling at your kid being like, you better enjoy every minute of this, you know, or whatever it is. And it serves a bunch of purposes. You are now happier, ready to enjoy it. You're going to make great memories and you're ready to spend again, which is, you know, Disney's mission is to be a successful business. So instead of speaking to the elephant and the rider, what they did was they created a journey for that elephant and rider to go down that is rigid enough that they actually know where you're going to end up. You're not wandering off eating that candy bar you're not supposed to. You're not suffering with these negative emotions. They've designed a journey so that you can enjoy the happiest place on earth.
Interesting.
And so when we design our experiences, and I run about 100 events a year just for our community, and then we design stuff for other companies all the time, and I do talks and offsites and all that kind of stuff. So this is the philosophy we use. We say, okay, what emotions do we want people to have at the end? And then how do we backwards design a journey that will actually get us there so that people can accomplish what it is that's important?
So good. What's your personal process for goal setting or just manifesting what you want? Is there anything or any specific questions that you ask yourself?
Because I'm a behavioral scientist, I really go to the research. And when you look at the research, it's pretty clear what really matters to human beings. So as far as money goes, having more money makes you happier, but it trails off how much happier it makes you, right? So the key for me when I was younger was like, let's get over that hump. And then it was, and do I tend to make more money from your, yeah, great, whatever. That's like, nice. But I don't have like some goal like, oh, in 10 years, I want the community to have 10,000 members and to be earning this much, because I don't actually think it matters. My goal is to live a life that's full of engagement. And engagement is when you feel like you're an active participant in your life and you're making progress. So whether I triple my income or I make 10% more, both of those probably feel really similar. And so I don't have like massive goals. I am incredibly organized over the long term. So in the early days when I was doing the dinners, I would say, okay, at some point I will have a story to tell and something to market. I don't know what it is. So let's make sure that at every dinner, there's one or two journalists.
So when it comes to things like having your book that came out, became a New York Times bestseller, you have people who are very good at their craft, who can lead that project for them rather than you needing to reverse engineer all that yourself.
So I did a few things. So I knew eventually there'd be something, right? So I had a whole slew of New York Times bestsellers who had attended the dinners and I was friends with them. So occasionally we gather the top minds and review best tactics. And then we have like kind of this shared doc that we can all pull from. As far as to get on the New York Times list, not only do you have to sell a lot of books, you have to have a lot of media. So I made sure to be friends with a lot of media people because eventually I would have this book or whatever it was to market. And then I also said, okay, I'm probably going to need a lot of pre-orders. So I should probably know a lot of people in the corporate world. So I made sure to build up a whole slew of relationships in the corporate world. But I wasn't inviting specific people being like, oh, I'm going to sell them a bunch of books. These were people who are accomplished that I wanted to be friends with. And then years later, I had this book and I was like, hey, can you help me with it? And because we had real relationships. So I tend to have trends, but I don't have like, oh, by next year, I need to earn this much. That kind of stuff tends to be more like every year, me and my wife have a conversation about what's important for the next year. And she'll tell me things like, okay, I want to spend a lot of time with friends and I want to, when we travel, spend it in really nice hotels. So then like, I know, okay, if we're going to allocate our budget, that's where it's going to be. But I'm not like, I don't want to run a 4-minute mile. I just want to feel like I'm making progress.
Yeah, it's so good. I think that's really, really important. For someone who wants to initiate behavioral change in a spouse or a business partner or someone else, what can they do to start giving them the awareness that perhaps they're doing some behaviors that are not ideal and then start to initiate that change if they seem very resistant to it in the first place?
Super interesting and also really tough question. One of the things I will point out is that even if you do all the right things, human beings are a pain in the butt. Like it's just the way we are.
I think everyone listening and watching this can be like, yes, agreed, 100%.
So let's start with a few things. One is let's get really clear if the behavioral change that you're looking for is something that's actually important or just something that bothers you, because it's much easier to be like, okay, I should just take a breath. This really isn't such a big deal, right? Like there are certain ways that my wife says stuff that I find like really annoying, but like that's my problem, not hers. She's wonderful. Like there's literally nothing to complain about. The second thing is if it's an actual problem, it turns out that rather than giving somebody advice, asking them for advice on it causes them to think through the problem and be more likely to take action towards it. There's a whole slew of strategies. One is, can you help them develop friends who have overcome / don't have that issue? So if I was hoping that my wife would exercise more, which she actually really loves to swim and stuff like that, so it's not an issue, I would keep inviting friends over that are very fitness oriented and suggest that, oh, well, rather than X, let's take a walk or whatever it is, right? Or a hike. The second is, I would ask her for advice on, like, hey, you know, so-and-so has been saying they'd like to get more fit. Do you have any advice? Maybe we can help them. And so that then they're invested in, not just by thinking through the problem and imagining solutions, but also invested in another person's outcome. Because we're often, depending on the personality, really willing to go out of our way to have somebody else succeed in ways that we wouldn't do for ourselves.
So good. You're moving people away from just being trapped alone with their own things too. Like that idea of connection with other, like for connection, obviously you need other people. That's really, really powerful. And a question I did want to ask you that I almost forgot about actually is, obviously it's useful to have a good connection and trust with yourself. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in terms of daily routine or different daily practices or rituals that can help someone get a better sense of who they are and where they want to go?
Who you are and where you want to go. And here's the question, how deep do you want me to go? Because like, I have a real answer for you here.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're okay. All for being real. Yeah, absolutely. And I know I've hit you with plenty of curveballs today.
Yeah, this is fine. This is one of my new areas that I'm looking in for my next book. Let's tackle this issue of who we are. The current trend is that people really love talking about authenticity, right? It's like, it's a lovely idea. Like there's this pure and true version of myself that's like deep in there, that's locked in. And when I act consistent with it, like I bring beauty into the world and it's really lovely. The problem is it's complete and utter bullshit. It doesn't exist. And the reason it doesn't exist is that the human brain is a collection of parts that are warring for control and have specialties and all that. And there isn't a unified self in there. Depending on how hungry you are, the time of day, the way you were raised, the last interaction you have, you would emerge as a completely different person. You want to see me being lovely? Feed me. You want to see me being a terrible human being? Watch me interact with anybody who's a customer service person on a phone call when I am like desperate to get a flight, right? Like I just become a jerk. I don't know why. I hate myself for it, but it's not because it's not my authentic self. It's just the version of me that emerges from the fighting components in my brain. Researchers had people sit at a table and have a conversation, let's say 4 or 5 people. And each person's job was to rate themselves and everybody else on their level of authenticity. And what they found was that my number for myself wouldn't match their number for me. But what's even more interesting, their numbers for me didn't match each other, meaning there was no unified perspective of what authenticity was. Not only that, but people who are claim to be like really authentic, who like say it as it is and all that, turns out they're much more likely to lie to seem authentic, which is just like comedic. So what does all this mean? It means that this true self that we think exists that doesn't is more likely a narrative that we believe that we have about ourselves. So if you look at, do you remember when Pepsi and Kylie Jenner had that ad with the Black Lives Matter movement? Mm-hmm. And they're like, everybody's like, you've just made us stupider and insulted the entire movement. People are like, that's not authentic. And the reason is that Kylie Jenner and Pepsi weren't part of that conversation to begin with. So it wasn't part of their narrative. And so it seemed inauthentic. Whereas when Apple talks about privacy, it comes off as really authentic because they've pissed off so many other companies with their privacy features. So if you want to know who you are is the narrative that you believe you are. So if your story about yourself is, oh, I'm useless, or your story about yourself is, I can do this, then what people would see as authentic to you is fundamentally different. So what does that mean? That means a few things. The first is that if I want to dive into me, well, then what's the story of me? Like, what's the narrative I have about myself? If I'm constantly talking crap about myself in my head, then that narrative is probably not a healthy one.
Absolutely.
And then you're conflating this. You aren't a thing. You're like, you could be literally a different human being 5 minutes from now.
Did people mark themselves a lot higher in terms of the authenticity scale than other people would have marked them as well?
Oh, I actually didn't. I should look back. I don't remember.
I thought that would be interesting. And you know what you said there that it reminded me of. So we, you know, when people send out like holiday cards, whenever I see people's like family pictures, a lot of them are like photoshopped and looking glamorous and all that type of thing. All I can think about is my own experiences getting these, you know, it shows us smiling and that's great. But behind the scenes, kids are eating sand. It's an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
Tears at the start, tears at the end, tears halfway through. They capture a couple of photos. We love our photographer and job done. So I just can't when I see these perfect images that people are just constantly putting up. I think anyone who has had that experience is like, look, I know that there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And I think letting people into that real journey is I'm not saying destroy your holiday cards, but, you know, the funniest Santa photos are the ones where the kid's screaming on Santa's lap rather than the happy family.
Pulling the beard off. Yeah, for sure. I think that there was a time when that veneer was okay, when like the first Instagram, like, popularity or whatever you want to call them started coming up, that like, okay, cool, we get it, you're giving this like glamorous view of the world, but right now people are kind of, I think, fed up with it because they know that you took that photo, but you had to starve yourself for 3 weeks to get into that outfit or whatever.
For sure. Like Kendrick Lamar already said, show me something natural. Like, it's so true. Everyone's sick of the Photoshop and the filters and all that, which I think is a really positive thing. A final question before the rocket round. On your best day, what's an affirmation that you would write on a flashcard to show yourself on your worst day?
I don't know if it'd be an affirmation. It would be call somebody you love. You know, it's so consistent. The things that make life fantastic are the people. And so on my worst day, I think the person, the thing that will make the biggest difference is actually hearing the voice of somebody I really care about.
So good. I think it's really powerful. Well, it's time to move into the Win the Day rocket round. 10 questions for some quick answers. You up for this one, John?
Yeah, let's do this. Come on.
Number one, what quote inspires you the most?
Oh, wow. I really love from Le Petit Prince, the little prince. He says, what matters to us is what we waste time on. And it points to like the ridiculousness of it. We're all wasting our time, but whatever we choose to waste our time, we love.
Number two, morning coffee or evening wine?
Oh, neither. I've never had a cup of coffee. And if I'm going to drink, it's going to be something, I think, a little bit more fun. Shots of tequila with friends or a nice whiskey or something. Yeah.
Number three, what's one bit of advice you would give your 18-year-old self?
Get people to cook you dinner.
Love it. Number four, what book do you gift the most or that contributed most to the mindset you have today?
Oh, that's so funny. I gift my book the most. But if it wasn't my book, it might be The Little Prince, actually.
Any particular lesson or was it what you mentioned earlier?
The story is about a boy traveling the stars with a sense of wonder that's just fantastic. And if you kind of like look across the board in life, the people who are the most curious have often the most potential to succeed.
I have WIN as an acronym. It stands for Wonder, Intent, Nurture. Mm-hmm. And the W for Wonder means it's having something like a vision bigger than you, pulling yourself out of bed every day and being intensely curious about your potential and how great you can be.
I love that.
So I love that you've shared those things. Number five, was there a vulnerability you once hid within that became your superpower?
I'm dyslexic. And you've heard me talk about this briefly. It was so painful in my childhood. And I would pretend to be sick when it was my turn to read in class and all these kind of things. But because of it, I ended up having to develop skills that nobody else has. And I think that that's why I'm pretty good at what I do today.
Quick question on that. How did you adjust the way that you learn in terms of all the academic papers and things that you must have been doing for your professional career?
That was, all that stuff is way, way later. The issues were really in my grade school. It was just such a struggle.
Yeah, for sure. Number six, what's one thing you've learned about failure?
One thing I've learned about failure, I would say, is the question, okay, now what? Like, it happened, what's next? And it's constantly, like, from, oh, you can't do that. Okay, then what's the next thing then? Like, just, okay, what's next? Let's move on.
I love that. Coach K, the Duke basketball coach, says next play. It's like, that's it. You focus on the next play, win, you know, good or bad, which is great. Number seven, if you could sit on a park bench and have a conversation with someone alive or dead, who would it be?
Oh my God. I get the dinner question like all the time, and I've hosted all these people. At this point, it would probably be Stan Lee. And he had such a thirst for life, such like a excitement and enthusiasm for the characters and the stories. And anybody who can live with that much wonder is just amazing to me.
Cool cameos right through to later.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As well, which was awesome.
I think he was battling, or his wish was to like have more cameos than Alfred Hitchcock. Hitchcock used to do his cameos.
Awesome. Number 8, what tool or resource best helps you run your life or your business?
The snooze feature on Gmail. Holy cow. I mean, the email I need is always when I need it, when I need it. And it reminds me to take care of everything. I'm obsessed with it.
Number 9, share one thing on your bucket list.
Oh, wow. I think I want to take my kids to Antarctica. I've been there twice, and I did this challenge a few years ago where I trained for 5 months to do a 10-minute 0-degree swim there. And it was insane. And I think it'd be super cool to do that with my kids.
You have to tell us. Give us 60 seconds of what that experience was like.
So doing it was actually easy relative to the training. The training was, I hired a level 3 Wim Hof breathing instructor. At one point, he actually moved in with me to prep me. And I would do things like breath work and then just walk around in like December in New York in a t-shirt and shorts for like periods of time and then come back. And it was just, you know, you do these breathing exercises and they are so intense that your joints lock, you're going through convulsions. You know, at one point I was holding my breath for 5 minutes at a time. It was like insanity. And then the day of, I managed to get a video call with him. I'm in Antarctica on a boat. We do the breath work and he's like, you've got this. And oddly, it was like, that was the easiest part of the whole thing. The training was the killer stuff.
Do you do cold plunges or cold showers or anything?
Yeah, that stuff's like easy. Yeah. But do I do them all the time anymore? No, not like when I was in training. There was a point where like for months I hadn't had a hot shower. And then I had one and I was like, what am I doing? This is so lovely. Like, why wouldn't I be doing this more often?
And once you've ticked off Antarctica, you have to move to a different planet to try and
Something crazier.
For the next level, yeah, for sure. And final question, number 10, what's one thing you do to win the day?
Oh, wow. At the end of every day, I ask my wife, does she feel loved? Does she feel appreciated? And does she feel cared for? And if she doesn't, then my mission becomes to do something about that.
So good. Well, there are a bunch of ways to connect with John. We'll link to all of these in the show notes. You can follow him on Instagram at John Levy TLB. Grab a copy of his new book, New York Times bestseller, You're Invited, on Amazon, and visit his website, influence.rs. Again, all that and more will be linked in the show notes. John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's been an absolute treat. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of the Win the Day podcast. We want to hear your thoughts on what we covered today, so drop a comment on the YouTube version of this episode with your favorite takeaway, any questions you have, or what actions you'll be taking as a result of what was shared in this episode. And if you found value in the Win the Day podcast, leave a 5-star rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link to both of those in the show notes. It'll only take you a few seconds, and more ratings really helps other people discover the show so they can get the mindset upgrade they need, and we can bring more winners into the Win the Day movement. That's all for this episode. Get out there and win the day. Until next time, onwards and upwards, always.